And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's a lot of talk these days about nature being in trouble, because it is. Yes, the oceans are being depleted. Yes, the Appalachians are being leveled for coal. Yes, hurricanes probably will become more destructive. Yes, polar bears are facing tough times ahead. But wait until you hear the latest. There's a chorus of alarm, and people are being asked to leap into action. Why? You'll find out when we return here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Here we are, right in the middle of summer. It's hot. But unless you're in one of the swelter belts, things always cool off in the evenings. The other night, I decided at midnight to head out to my new hammock and spend the night outdoors. Just grabbed a pillow and a blanket, and before long I was lost in the sounds of night, which in San Diego means primarily the community of crickets. But I've spent nights out in other places, where many of you listening are now, where the nights are filled with the sounds of the frogs. Frogs almost always make people smile. Many of them have a perpetual built-in smile. And those attentive eyes. They're almost always portrayed in legend as magical or mystical, probably because so many of them, if you take them and stretch them out a bit, have a peculiarly human sense about them, with big eyes, big mouth, arms with fingers, and legs with toes. And they bring smiles and laughter to even the smallest child, when suddenly, bip, they hop. And no land creatures can compete with the variety of colors. Frogs rule the terrestrial worlds of color. They're vibrant and vivid and bold, with oranges and blues and reds, yellows and greens, which they dazzle the human spirit with. And the most amazing thing of all is that they and all their cousin amphibians may become extinct. Researchers are reporting a sudden and significant decline and disappearance of amphibians around the world. It is one of the most disturbing predictions I've ever heard. Today, we hear from Dr. Andrew Blaustein, who has been researching and tracking the decline of amphibians. And in our second segment, we continue with Dr. Robin Moore, who's with Conservation International, and hear what they are learning about the worldwide decline and how he and others are fighting to preserve this whole class of creatures. And in segment three, we play a recent commencement address delivered to the graduating class of one of the Wildside News' great allies, the Presidio School of Management in San Francisco. Robert Kennedy Jr. provides a powerful analysis of the struggles that are at work, which are shaping the future of life on Earth. It's all coming up after the news. So we hop right into our features, but first, the news. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger took a bold step, which allied him with environmentalists from around the country, as he formally asked the federal government to protect 4.4 million acres of national forest lands from any new roads for timber, oil, or gas exploration and other development. Following federal guidelines established by the Bush administration, Governor Schwarzenegger exerted his right as governor to decide whether or not to permit such road expansions on public lands. Similar gubernatorial actions have taken place in New Mexico, Virginia, South and North Carolina. The governor's request must now be approved by the federal government, but Mark E. Ray, Undersecretary for National Resources and Environment at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees national forests, said he doesn't see anything in the Schwarzenegger petition that stands in the way of an acceptable conclusion. Environmentalists applaud Governor Schwarzenegger, but are cautious that governors in other timber-rich states may opt for opening up their forests to roads to riches from resource development. Some might say that in California, anyway, if you can't beat them, then join them. Fishermen along California's coast who have relied on bottom trawling for fishing income are selling their rights, provided through federal trawling permits, to the highest bidders, who are turning out to be environmental organizations, specifically the Nature Conservancy. The Conservancy, which has a legacy of purchasing critical habitat from property owners at fair market price, is branching out into purchasing rights and thereby protecting threatened habitat. The deals being struck are kept private, but fishermen are willing to reveal that they agree to not get back into the trawling business. Besides the trawling permits, the Conservancy is willing to purchase the fishermen's boats and is considering transforming some of them into research vessels to study and protect the ocean fauna and flora. So far, the deals are being well received, according to Jeff Betancourt, a fisherman who agreed to sell his permit. They didn't come telling us they hate fishermen. Some of the fishermen plan to continue fishing, but in a sustainable way, with baited traps and hooks and lines. A spokesbeing for Pacific Fish Species said that whole communities of fish are breathing a sigh of relief with the news and are planning to get back to raising their families and getting back into a school of their choice. Gorillas, being social animals, tend to hang out in groups. This behavior, unfortunately, has caused devastation in certain gorilla populations in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where estimates are that within the past 2 years, 97% of the gorilla population is gone due to the spread of the Ebola virus. Following an Ebola outbreak in the human population in October of 2003 in a hunting village in Umbanza, which regularly relied on bushmeat, the Ebola quickly spread to the regional gorilla population and resulted in the deaths of thousands of gorillas, effectively wiping out the population. Such stories make clear the need to move quickly to deal with the emerging crashes in animal populations around the world, as downward trends and projections can become history overnight, as disease and epidemics can quickly eradicate whole populations of animals. And the Senate this week turned back a general moratorium on offshore oil and gas drilling, as it opened up exploration and leases in designated areas of the Gulf, known as Lease Areas 181, and in areas outside a 125-mile limit along the Florida coast. Although many in Florida are vehemently opposed to the bill to reopen offshore drilling, stating that the Florida economy is directly tied to their beaches, the deal gained enough crossover from certain Democrats, specifically Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, as the royalty split was dramatically changed to provide up to 50% returns to participating states. In the past, states affected by offshore drilling received on average 2% of royalties. Naturally, the federal government is opposed to this new legislation as it dramatically impacts the revenues historically received by the U.S. government. The Senate bill, which is opposed generally by the major environmental groups, is still better than the House version of the bill, which decreased the buffered protection to 60 miles offshore and sweetened the deal by offering between 50 and 75% of royalties to the states. The bill is expected to be up for vote in the Senate by the end of the month. And that's the news. And a few reminders. If you'd like to become a friend of the Wild Side News, click on the Participate button and contact us. We're also looking for new partners to help share our mission. And if you are someone who wants to both help keep the voice of the Earth alive and get your message out to our listeners, contact us about becoming a regular sponsor on the Wild Side News. We're getting ready to launch our outreach. You can do it now. We now turn our attention to today's feature. Is it true what we hear about amphibians becoming extinct? We go in depth to find out in our first two segments. My associate producer is really wonderful in the sense that she brings me all these stories she pulls out of the mainstream press. And one really caught my eye, and this is what it says. It says, experts warn of total amphibian extinction, fearing cataclysm. from my perspective, as a person alive in 2006 and having lived for 50-some years here, this is the most shocking prediction I've ever heard in my life. Because when we talk about the extinction of amphibians, we're talking about a major catastrophe, the likes of which I had never even imagined was, what shall we say, we're all aware of the fact that things can go bad, but this is really terribly wrong. We're now going to bring in someone who has been studying this particular phenomenon, has been studying specifically amphibians and their habits and sort of things that are affecting them. And this is Dr. Andrew Blaustein, who is with the Department of Zoology at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Dr. Blaustein, welcome to the Wild Side News.
How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
I'm doing great. And I'm sure you are too, but I think possibly some of your research is a bit shocking. We're going to talk about this story, and I want to get your take on this. One of the things that wasn't covered in this particular story is sort of the time frame. Maybe why don't we just start out with that, if you're familiar with this specific sort of take on this, this concept that amphibians may become extinct. What kind of time frame are scientists and researchers talking about?
Well, I'm not going to be that alarmist about it. Now, we have a major problem. We have a biodiversity crisis, which covers all life on the planet. And amphibians seem to be much harder hit than many of the vertebrate groups, such as mammals or birds or fish. However, I cannot put a time frame on this, and no one else can either, I don't think. There are lots of species that are in trouble right now. There are lots of populations in trouble. But to say that the entire class is going to be extinct soon, that would not be correct.
Right. Well, soon is a relative term.
Yeah.
However, there is evidence already of some quickening in terms of the attack on the amphibian class. Some of this is alarming. I, like you, don't wish to be alarmist unless we need to be. And so I'm trying to kind of walk that edge between being alarmist and trying to educate and make people aware of just what is happening. So
well, let me put you in a little bit of perspective in my shoes here. In the mid-1980s, when I was studying the ecology and behavior of amphibians and small mammals, we found it increasingly difficult to find many populations of amphibians that were common for many, many years in the state of Oregon, Pacific Northwest in general. So I've been noting this type of decline for quite some time, and we've been doing research on various potential causes for it. And obviously, this is a big picture now. We've seen it all over the world. Now, to put it in perspective, this is an alarmist type statement. Now, think about it. Amphibians are a class of animals, vertebrates, that includes salamanders and frogs and toads. They're all common. We know that these things from collecting them as kids and all that. And the fact of the matter is, if there's about roughly the same number of species of amphibians on the planet as there are mammals, give or take hundreds either way.
About 6,000 roughly. So,
yeah, 5,000 to 6,000, depending upon who you're looking at. Now, let me say this. If somebody said the entire class of mammals, excluding people maybe because we're mammals, were going extinct or were in trouble or were having alarming population declines, you're talking about giraffes and rhinos and lions and rodents and armadillos and raccoons and cats and dogs, that would shake people up.
It certainly would.
Mm-hmm. So that's a class. So yeah. Are amphibians. We're talking about lots of frogs, toads, and salamanders and other types of animals.
Well, that's a really important aspect of this particular announcement, and that is the fact that it's affecting a whole class. As you say, if it was affecting mammals as a class, we would say, what in the world is specific to the mammal population that is bringing about this problem? So let's ask that in that same question in terms of what is it about amphibians, therefore, that make them so susceptible to this dramatic impact on their populations?
Yeah, that's a good question, and people have been asked that a lot. And amphibians seem to be really good indicators of environmental change. Now, they're not protected like mammals or birds, for example, from some environmental conditions such as increasing ultraviolet radiation. They have thin skin. They don't have hair or feathers. Their eggs are laid right out in the open. They don't have hard outer shells in their eggs. They're cold-blooded animals, or ectothermic is the technical term. They have to go with the flow in terms of the temperature. Sometimes they can control it by going in and out of sun, but if we have increasing global climate change, like increased warming, or we have increasing ultraviolet radiation, or we have increasing emerging infectious diseases, these things are going to get caught because they don't have the protection that other vertebrate groups have. They can't fly away. They don't have the feathers. They don't have the hair. And they don't have the thick shells.
One of the things that I like to use as an example of the sensitivity of amphibians is a kind of an analogy that if we think about the difference between our skin, which is a protective organ, and our eyes, we happen to know that our eyes are one of the most sensitive areas of our body. If you get so much as a little fleck or any sort of chemical in your eye, you feel it immediately. And that's kind of how I like to think of, in terms of amphibians, the fact that their skin as well is dependent and sort of very much associated with water and moisture, and therefore much more reactive to just about everything. And I think that may be one of the reasons that they end up being these indicators of change so dramatically. What is the nature of your research? I know has been really quite broad spectrum, although you've done a lot of research that relates to the effects of ultraviolet. But now let's talk about what your research and others is indicating as the cause of this.
Well, personally, I think there are several causes. And each thing is hitting amphibians one at a time or collectively. It depends upon where you go. Obviously, ultraviolet affects some amphibians, but not all. Contaminants, pesticides such as atrazine affect some amphibians, but not all. And not all the amphibians are equally affected. Emerging infectious diseases are the big thing right now. Now, think about this. There are at least, I think, five major pathogens of amphibians. The one that's most current in the news right now is this Batrachochytrium, or a fungus. Fungus that is questionable as to its origin, but it's emerging, and that means it was either around for a long time and some environmental change occurred to spring it forward, or it's new in some regions, and I think it's a combination of both. I think it's probably new in some regions, and it's been around in others. We know for a fact that it's been around for decades in some regions of North America, but it's just popping out more often now.
Well, why?
And that's a good question. We're trying to get a handle on it. It's a relatively new discovery on amphibians. It was probably first recognized as an important process in amphibians by a group primarily based in Australia in the late 1990s. That's not very long ago. Berger is the senior author of that major paper that I'm thinking of. And we now know that it's found on all continents where amphibians are found. Why is it popping out? Good question. There's a great hypothesis, I think, that was published in Nature just a few months ago by Alan Pounds, who says global climate change is probably triggering this infectious disease. It makes it more ideal. This global warming makes it more ideal for the fungus to live. I think there are other things going on, too. There may be contaminants that depress immune systems. We know that some contaminants can do that. There could be other diseases acting together with this disease. There's a whole host of possibilities here.
Well, I know one of the theories that's being talked about, and that is that as global warming happens, certain temperatures of water increase by certain small amounts, really, and that can be the advantage to this particular is it a bacteria?
This is a fungus.
Fungus, that's correct.
About. But there are bacteria involved, too, and there are other species of there are other types of pathogens that are out there.
It's sort of like what happens if you keep milk works well in a refrigerator, but you take it out and you leave it out for a little bit, and it doesn't take very long for the temperature to radically increase the spread of various organisms in milk and turning it bad right away. That could be conceivably what's happening, that there is an advantage given to a slight temperature increase in the waters due to global warming, and therefore these animals are thriving more. Am I correct on
that? That's possible. It's a little bit more complicated. Essentially, what I think Pounds has showed in his group down there in Central America was that I think there are warmer temperatures at night and cooler temperatures in the day, which makes it ideal for the fungus.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And as well, UV rays with the depletion of our ozone also have. We've been warned ourselves that we have to be careful of being out in the sun too long.
Lots of countries have recognized this, and that's why there was probably the greatest treaty ever signed environmentally-wise by most of the nations on the planet. It's called the Montreal Protocol, which is to stop most ozone-depleting chemicals and phase them out relatively soon.
Right.
So we recognize ultraviolet. It's not good for you.
Well, now, are you know, a number of years back, there were these stories about the funny frogs, okay? The frogs with the three legs and the four legs and the two heads and the three tails and all sorts of different things. And it was kind of treated by the press as sort of one of those funny stories, you know? Look at this, isn't this funny? In reality, that perhaps was the beginning of the change. Was that was it an indicator that change was coming?
Well, actually, those stories kind of popped out as a side aspect of the amphibian decline situation. And there's a little bit of a controversy remaining on what's causing those multiple-legged frogs. Hmm. But I'm of the school where we think it's a parasite. It's a typical flatworm that causes these things to bud out extra legs or messes up their limb development. Now, the problem is, why is this flatworm around? And we think that has something to do with contaminants. Mm-hmm. Contamination. Peter Johnson from the University of Wisconsin has got some really good evidence showing that contaminants can increase the prevalence of these pathogens. Other people, such as Joe Kiesecker, who's at the Nature Conservancy, has experimentally shown that certain types of contaminants can depress immune system and cause them to get these pathogens. So there's all kinds of complex interactions here.
One of the questions I'm curious about, and although I've studied biology, I don't have a good handle on this, and I mean, I certainly know about amphibians, but in terms of, they're kind of these creatures that we only see on occasion. Many of us don't see amphibians very often at all. And so they're kind of off our radar screen. What I'd be curious about is, where do they fit in terms of their place in these food chains? What if, for example, if you talk about mass extinction of different amphibian species, what animals will no longer be eaten by these? What are amphibians eating, and then what eats them?
Let's put this in perspective. Amphibians are incredibly great pest control agents, so to speak. For example, the Australians tried to import cane toads into Australia to control sugarcane pests. Unfortunately, that didn't work because the sugarcane pests come out at different times of the day than the cane toads do. But toads and frogs eat billions and trillions of insects annually, and they eat tons of this stuff, so they control insect pests. If you took away all the salamanders and all the frogs and all the toads tomorrow, I would expect you to see a lot more mosquitoes and flies and gnats and things like that. Now, lots of things eat amphibians. Other amphibians eat amphibians. Snakes eat amphibians. Birds eat amphibians. Some rodents eat amphibians. Raccoons eat amphibians. These things are really important aspects of many ecological communities. There are at least two regions that show that amphibians have the greatest biomass, that is, the amount of amphibians in the area is greater than the other vertebrates.
Now, where's that?
And that's northeastern United States in some regions and certain other areas.
That is amazing. That's something, yeah, I had no idea.
You know, a lot of the amphibians you don't see. They're under the soil or they're in leaf litter. They're salamanders. There's lots of salamanders in the southeastern United States, northeastern United States, too.
Well, now, are you finding as well, for example, the salamander populations in areas where they were predominant decreasing?
That's a good question, too. There are some data now that show that salamander populations in some regions are also on decline. Some of the best data for that are from the southeastern United States.
Well, I know that when I grew up in the Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and boy, hunting frogs, just going out and catching frogs was something you could just spend a whole many days of a summer just doing. And kind of messing with frogs. I'm just curious if I were to go back to those areas now, because they were everywhere. If you went anywhere, pond or particularly around ponds, I mean, there was a massive migration of frogs underfoot. If I were to go back there now, and I haven't, say, I've been away from those areas for 25, 30 years, living in New Mexico, for example, so I've been away from the amphibians. Do you think I might see a difference in the populations now?
Well, in some regions you would. If you were growing up in the Midwest, I think you would see the leopard frog populations have declined. Now, I don't know if they've rebounded or not, but spring peepers have declined all throughout the Midwest, the Wisconsin-Michigan area, and there are various possible causes for these declines. But the fact of the matter is I'm a New York City kid, and I used to go to New England all the time in the summer to collect frogs, and I know that they're not as common as they used to be.
Yeah, that's something I haven't been able to witness that change. I'm going to have to go back there and just walk through some of those areas again, and I'll know the difference. because it was dramatic. I mean, they were just everywhere. It's a sad story. What's your take on this? I mean, where do we go from here? What could we possibly do? This seems like it's a very complex issue. What are some of the things that people, first of all, need to start thinking about in the short term?
Well, people have to be aware of the complex interactions that all types of organisms have with one another. And if we lose a frog, it is a big deal. If we lose many frogs, it's a bigger deal. And it also has something to do with an environmental change or environmental damage. You just have to be aware that this is an important aspect of every life of all types of living organisms on the planet. And try to make other people aware of this. And then we could try to do something. We have to get baseline information. We're just studying the problem now. It's a relatively new problem with amphibians, not that old, but we need more and more information. And we have to enlighten people. We have to enlighten your friends, government officials. We want to stop damaging the environment. That's the big issue, I think.
Well, if this trend continues, and there's nothing to suggest that it's going to turn around anytime soon, and it could go either way, explain again to people who haven't had a chance to really think about this, how this could then impact the other animal species, particularly those who rely on them. We may see dramatic changes in their populations as well. This, of course, is what everyone talks about.
You know, if I had the power to say, okay, poof, there go all the amphibians tomorrow, I would say that there could be lots of insect pests that would increase, which would carry potential diseases such as malaria, all kinds of sleeping sickness, things like that. You know, these amphibians control those animals that host those bad bugs. I would say that fish populations could crash because some of the fish populations rely on amphibians to eat. Some of the snake populations, you may not care that snake populations go down, but if they go down, other things will go down too. There's all kinds of implications here. But here's a big thing, too, that you should realize. Amphibians are almost, many of these species of amphibians are just figuring out, are living pharmaceutical industries. They have lots of chemicals on their backs. They have chemicals that have been shown to stop viruses from growing, that are used in herpes simplex to control that, for example. They have antibiotics on them. There's even one compound that seems to be used now for AIDS. So we're losing potential, unbelievably untapped potential for pharmaceutical products from these natural animals.
For listeners who may want to go out and start opening up their eyes to become more aware about amphibians, tell them how to become more aware in the field.
Well, I'll tell you one thing to do, first of all, is go to amphibiaweb.org. And that's probably the best site for amphibians on the web right now. It's run out of UC Berkeley system. That has links to everything.
Okay. But now for the person who wants to just get out and they're walking around, once you know how to look, you start noticing. How can you help people increase their capacity to become aware of amphibians when they're in the field? Where do they go, first of all?
Well, first of all, if you go to almost any small body of water, that's freshwater, that is, you should be able to see some type of amphibian, no matter where you live in North America. For example, if you live in the Northeast, there's tons of amphibians still around in certain regions. Some have disappeared due to the various reasons we talked about. Southeast, you can see salamanders relatively commonly. You can lift up leaf litter, rocks, logs, shale. But almost any body of water that doesn't have really strong flowing water should give you some types of amphibians. Even the flowing water has some.
Now, there's a rather interesting thing about amphibians, which also is, from my perspective, one of the greatest gifts, and that is the fact that they are some of the most colorful creatures on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
I don't believe there's any animal. I mean, the fish certainly can compete. But sometimes you have to look really hard because it's difficult to find them because they're so well camouflaged. And in the other case, some of these are very brightly colored. Give us a little handle on both sides of that story.
Okay, so the colors, the really brilliant colored ones, are found in the tropics. And we studied some of these in Costa Rica, for example. Poison dart frogs are some of the most intensely colored of all, bright yellows, blues, greens. These colored frogs have noxious compounds on their skin. This is what I was trying to tell you. But a noxious compound, it's a warning color, so to speak, so do not eat me, I'm noxious. but in very low doses, those noxious compounds can be medicines. So essentially what they're doing is warning, don't eat me, but they're also, as I said, containing all kinds of chemicals, and these chemicals may be cures for certain diseases by people.
Why are you doing this? Why are you so fascinated with these creatures?
Well, I've been studying, I'm an ecologist, and I study interactions of animals and things like that. We studied the poison dart frogs down in Costa Rica. We study their behavior is really interesting. The species we studied, the strawberry poison dart frog, is about the size of my pinky nail, and it's the males are extremely aggressive towards one another, and they fight for little light gaps. Wherever there's a light gap in the forest, they set up a territory.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And that's how we started with some of those guys.
So these guys wrestle, I suppose, because they've got the arms and fingers.
Yeah, they wrestle, and sometimes they just didn't even make it that far. One guy comes up, and the other guy pushes them, and they're gone.
That's great. Well, listen, there's many, many stories. If people want to find out more about what you're doing, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, the Oregon State University website, and you can go under Blaustein, the zoology department, and I've got some stuff up there. You can even read some of my publications.
Listen, I want to thank Dr. Andrew Blaustein with the Department of Zoology at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon, for joining us here on the Wild Side News. Thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot.
There's a lot to be learned about the amphibian realms, and there's a lot to be done to keep them around. And in just a moment, we head to the nation's capital to find out what's being done around the world when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.